Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. The Messiah's covenant with humanity via Abraham is the foundation of our faith. In this study, recalling Abraham's journey of trust in heaven, starting in Genesis 12, we see the power of the Spirit to transform and empower us as overcomers of the attractive lure of a world steeped more in the knowledge of bad than of good. Like the new names for Abram and Sarai recorded in Genesis 17, the Messiah's new name and our new identity in Him call us to a life of spiritual renewal, where we boldly proclaim His glory and advance His kingdom. May we, like Abraham, walk in unwavering faith, knowing that our Redeemer lives and reigns forever.
In this journey that we've gone through in Genesis 12 through 17, you've seen this progression of from the call of Abraham to get going, get out of the land where you were in, with land that was quite a bit going separate from the ways of God, steeped in a belief system, lots of different deities. As we know from things we've dug up that had a different view of how the world came to be, and also things related to the flood and such, he was called out. Abram was called out. And we see in this passage here today that the Apostle Paul talks about Abram as the father of us all, and that trust in the Lord, like Abraham had, is something that is a model for all of us. And we see that this response, this act of trusting God, started from the moment he was called to, hey, lech lecha, get going, all the way up to where you see this particular passage that we're in today, where you have this symbol of circumcision, this sign of the covenant, the sign of this deal between heaven and earth. But it's going to continue throughout the rest of Abraham's life. And you see his children, how his children are raised up, and as that moves forward. And we'll see as this grows up to a crescendo as to where Abraham is asked to take an even bigger leap of faith, to trust the Lord, to offer up his one and only son. So here you see the cry from Abraham in this, well, hey, what about Ishmael? But the Lord says, no, I have given you specifically Yitzhak. Yes, Ishmael is going to be blessed too, because he came from you, and your family is blessed, and there will be a blessing for Ishmael. We all can hear thousands of years later be not so happy about the blessing given to Ishmael. However, that was a blessing that was given to Ishmael. And again, that's one of those things that blessings can be poured out. And as you see in some passages where it talks about that God causes what? The sun to shine on who? All just the good, all the good people, they only get the sunshine, and it just rains on all the bad people? No. All people. He causes the sun to shine on everyone, the just and the unjust. So, if there's a blessing that goes out because you're connected to Abraham, it is a blessing that goes out because you're connected to Abraham. Now, what happened with the descendants of Ishmael, you know, we can see, and it's even foretold in the blessings that come to Ishmael as to what kind of result and legacy was going to come through his family. But it's one of those things that even we can pray, and we've seen that prayer answered many times across the nations, even in modern times, where the prayer that goes out that they would remember their father Abraham, remember where the blessing started from, and who was the one that actually got that all started, and who was where that blessing was actually going toward, and what that promised seed was really going to be all about. And that seed was not about, hey, you have to have a physical son and do it your way, thus Ishmael. But no, there would be a promised seed that would come through, and ultimately that promised seed was going to be the Messiah, the great seed, the seed of the woman that would be fulfilled, that would crush the head of the serpent, that would be putting an end to all the misery that's been going on planet Earth all the way from the beginning, from the tree in the garden. So, thus, as we see Abraham learning to trust the Lord throughout his life, that is a lesson for us too, because we have the faith of Abraham as well. And for us, trust is going to be a thing that's going to happen throughout our life, from taking baby steps to, just like Abraham did, to also taking steps backward because we lack trust or think we want to do things our own way. But then also stepping forward in faith as well, stepping forward in that trust in the Lord. So then when we go in here further into Genesis chapter 17, you know, we see an interesting thing that is talked about with El Shaddai. And various people have come up over the years, and you'll see in rabbinical writings, they'll come up with some various ideas on where Shaddai comes from. Is it from Shaddad, which means to destroy? So is Shaddai then means the one who destroys? Is that where it comes from? Is the that, and this you see, okay, goes back to the flood. So the one who destroys. And like we've talked about later on, when we get down to the book of Numbers and we see that, you know, Bilam or Balaam, he was known in outside the Bible in writings that have been found in the time period, that he was a big, you could say, diviner of these deities that were variously called the Shadim, or those that are powerful ones. Well, so, okay, Shaddai, Shadim, what are these particular powerful ones? One other particular one that some have seen is perhaps it could be, and that could be fitting to the context of this particular passage in Genesis 17, that it could come from the Hebrew word of shad, and shad is one of those that refers to the breasts of a mother. So thus you say that the one who comforts you. So one of the things that you'll see in reference to the Lord, and he's talked about in racham, rachamim, in compassion, the compassionate one. Well, racham is a word that's also commonly used for the womb of a mother. So thus you get these pictures of the Lord as not just, you can take the derivation of Shaddad, that he's the one who destroys, but also as Shad, the one who nurtures, comforts, nourishes, feeds, of Racham, the one who holds and carries the people and gives birth to the people at the right time. So thus you get these differing pictures of it, of this picture of El Shaddai. Either you take it the God who is the destroyer or the God or the one who nourishes. And various ways you can take that. But then when we get down into some other names, so we see that there's in this particular passage, there are some name changes in Genesis 17. Name changes that go from Avram to Avraham. And lots of people over the centuries have also seeing, well, what are the components of the names that are being referred to? And some have taken Avram as being Av for father, and Rum is a Hebrew verb that means to be lofty. So thus, you'll see it often referred to as Avram means exalted father, or father is exalted. Different ways that you could put that there as well. But we see that in other interesting things that you get from the cognate languages, such as the Akkadian from the lands that Avram came from, that Av is also a word that means, it can be used to mean a verb that means the one who decides. But then we also see that in the in the genealogies that you see in the Bible in Genesis 5 and 11, that you have the verb for that we use commonly translated as yalad, which means we often translate that as to beget. But yalad is a verb form of a noun that yeled, which means a child or a descendant of it. So thus, you see in some of the other genealogies that so-and-so was so many years old, and then he became the Av of somebody else. So Av can also be one that is an ancestor to, becomes an ancestor, or another way of saying the one who begets. So, I mean, isn't that really appropriate when he's talked about Avraham as the father of all believers, the one who begets all believers? Where do you see that the source of belief coming from? Now, when you see the fuller version of the name of Avraham, some various people have taken a stab at what that could possibly mean, and Avraham as could possibly be a combination of Av again for father, the begetter, and also the Hebrew verb of Hama, which is interesting because it's often translated as to make a multitude. But you'll see in a couple of the lexicons, like the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament and also the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon, well, notes that yes, it can mean a multitude, but the way it's often used is it's a multitude because of some sort of tumult or commotion or making a lot of noise. So it is very interesting that you can see that that it's also possible that you see that Avraham is becoming the father of not just many, but a noisy many. These are a many that are going to make a lot of noise on the earth, to make a commotion or tumult into the earth, to shake things up. And well, what have we actually seen the legacy of Avraham? Not just lots of people, but people that have made a difference in the world over time. Whether they be few, whether they be scattered across the planet, they still make a difference. Because if you are keeping the legacy of what Avraham was called out, who he trusted, and what he was carrying forward through his descendants down, it wasn't just having lots of kids, because anybody can have lots of kids. But what is it that your descendants actually do? What tumult, what noise are they making in the world? And that noise that has come throughout the world has been what? Praise the words of God throughout all the earth. That kind of a commotion or getting attention of people, making a noise, is something that you can see is one of the great legacies of Avraham. So thus, when you see his name listed there is Av Hamon Goim, or the father of multitudes of nations, that thus it is not just of many between all of the nations, but of noisy ones carrying out the words of God and the legacy of God throughout all the world. So then we get to Sarai. And Sarai is commonly seen as a combination of Sar, which is the Hebrew word for a ruler or a prince, and the Hebrew letter of Yod, which is often seen, it can mean different things, but can also mean, if it's tagged on to a noun, it can mean my, being a way to show a possessive. So it could thus be, you'll see some translations will put it as my princess, or my ruler with me. So then the name change goes to Sarah, and thus you see with that one, you've got Sar again, or its ruler, and then you get the letter He on the end of it, which is a common way, not always, but a common way that you'll see a designation for a word that is a feminine form of a verb. And so with this one, you can have a female ruler, or we would otherwise call that a queen or a princess, some woman who is in authority or ruling over something. So thus you see, well, what is it that she is the mother of? And it's interesting to note that she's called, and she will be of nations, kings and peoples will come from her. That she will be of nations, of these multitudes, and that not just multitudes will come from her, but people who are rulers over other people, kings, will come from her, and of all the peoples. And we've seen this kind of name change throughout Scripture as to where names are extremely important throughout Scripture, where you have Adam or dirt man, because it comes from Adama, or the ground. So it's a very interesting picture that you have of Adam is man of the dust, man. And thus, well, isn't that appropriate? Because it talks about there with the creation of Adam, what did the Lord do? And it talks about there in Genesis chapter 2, he formed the dirt man from the dust, and then he breathed into this dust, this dirt, the breath of life. And then, at that point, Avram became a nefesh chayim, or a soul that is living. Then you see also, we've talked about before with Chava, or Eve, being mother of the living, and her name is related to Chai. So thus, when he talks about that she is the mother of all the living, Chai, or life, is within her name there. So thus, you're going to see that life is going to be coming from the woman, and the seed of the woman is then going to be the great blessed one for all of the earth, not just some select clique of people that know the right handshake. And you also see another interesting picture of some of the first humans that we have here recorded in the Bible, of Havel or Abel, and being breath or vanity. So you see that a form of that name showing up a lot in the book of Ecclesiastes, because when it talks about vanity, vanity, Havel, Havel, Havel shows up a lot in there. So it is very interesting when you get this picture in Ecclesiastes. Well, all is just wind. All is just this temporary state of things. But you see the interesting tension that goes throughout that entire book of Qehelet, that it is not just a futile thing. You can try and strive after this and strive after that, strive after wisdom, strive after after riches, strive after power. But what is it that actually endures through all of it? That is not just wind. That is not just something that is fleeting. You see, in the end of the matter, it's that, well, to the commandments of the Lord, to keep the commandments of the Lord. Those are the things that matter. When is all said and done, and you get through all the chapters of Ecclesiastes, you get to the final matter that what is really true and lasting are the words of God. And we see that here and today, that when things are shifting around us, when people lose touch and sense over what the basic definitions of life are, and when does life actually begin? When people start losing touch of some of those fundamentals of things, you have the words of the Lord that keep us grounded. In the beginning, he created them male and female. I knitted you together in your mother's womb. So you have those grounding points that no matter whether these winds of culture blow this way or blow that way, there are some things that are sturdy. You see, Yeshua told a parable very similar to that about building your house on sand or building it upon a rock, a tsur. What is it that you want to build your life upon? Something that will shift and wash out from underneath you, or something that no matter what court of wind, waves, rain is battering against it, it will have its strength because of what? How well the house is built, or more about where the house is anchored to, so that it won't shift out from underneath it. Yeah, because, you know, if you have a wonderfully built house, yet it's not anchored to anything, well, what will happen? It will just get carried away. And we've seen that with recent floods, that you'll see this whole house intact will be floating down a river. So it survived getting hit by the flood. It survived getting ripped off of its foundation. So it's all intact there, but it's now swept away because what it was anchored to was not a strong connection. So that is definitely a great lesson for us in what we actually anchor ourselves to, that it's not a breath or vanity. And then, you know, another great name that we have is Shet or Seth. And that is seen as meaning either a replacement or a substitute for it. So names are hugely important. So that when you see that the names are changing for Avram and Sarai, that those names are speaking forward into what their lives are going to be, what impact they are going to have into all the world, which is very interesting as we see ourselves in that renaming process. And something that you see is that with the renaming, you'll see who has precedence or who has superiority over somebody else. So we see that there are these name changes we'll be seeing coming along throughout the history of Israel. We'll see here in coming chapters how Yaakov gets changed from being a heel or a supplanter, something that sticks out, protrudes out, to Israel, or one who struggles with God, or one who rules with God. There's that the word sader again. And you see also names that will be changing from like Shlomo or his peace, Solomon, to Yedidiah, or beloved of the Lord. So it's a very interesting picture that even though Shlomo's name changes, his life also has a trajectory to it, doesn't it? It starts out, and you'll see that it comes out of the hard scrabble that's through David's kingdom as he's growing up, and the hard scrabble and the fight between the brothers, and through the civil war that results from the brothers fighting for superiority. Then out the other side, he has this great call for wisdom, that he wants to be blessed with wisdom. That's what he wants. And you see examples of where he is granted great wisdom in being able to decide things, to look forward. And one of the things that he does with wisdom is building the house of God, to take those plans, that idea, to take that idea that David had for building a house for God, and then bringing that into reality to make that happen, to build it with wisdom. And then you see also that this great move from the various names of the coming one, the great Messiah, from called variously the branch or the son of man, and then with the name of Yehoshua, or as it came there in the first century to be shortened to Yeshua, you know, the Lord saves. But then when we see for us here today, and for all believers, we who are descendants of Abraham, who have the same kind of trust that Abraham had, that we who overcome the world, and you see this with several of the letters or the messages that come to the seven congregations there in Revelation, those seven ecclesia in Revelation, that they are told to overcome. And that's a part of the journey. So when we talk about with Abraham, his journey was started with Lech Lecha, get going. Get going from the land you are in. And his life from then on was going to be one of overcoming, overcoming, overcoming. And one of the things that you see that he had to overcome, and that's a part of trust, was overcoming his fear of death, that he was going to die and not be bringing to fulfillment this particular mission that he was on. But he had to trust that the Lord was going to keep him alive until that promise would be fulfilled. Even though it looked like he would not be able to have children, either himself or Sarai, too old to have children, or whether that he was being enslaved by Egypt or some other power. No. Yes, I'll do it myself. No, it was something that he had to learn, that he was going to overcome by the power of God that was going to direct him and lead his steps toward it. So in some of these accounts we have, like in Revelation 2:17, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the ecclesia. To him who overcomes, to him I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone and a new name written on the stone, which no one knows but he who receives it. So with that, you see some of that knowledge of where knowing the Torah is helpful and having an idea of what's being talked about here. Okay, well, we know from the Torah about manna, right? What is it? That stuff that came out of the sky? Some of the hidden manna? So starting off first with the manna. What was that? That was literally daily bread that was coming. That was going to sustain them throughout the desert when they had nothing that they could really depend upon because they were out in the desert. Yet the Lord would give them food, would make that food appear 6 days a week and twice as much on the sixth day to hold them over through the Shabbat until the cycle started all over again. So daily bread, who gives you the daily bread? This hint of hidden manna, you get a hint of it in Deuteronomy, where you see in Deuteronomy chapter 8, where it says, man will not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. So thus, what is the daily bread that carries you through? The words of God. That your word I have hidden in my heart. Yes, so there you go. That daily bread that's hidden in the heart carries you through. Revelation 2:17, talking about the hidden manna. And you give him a white stone, a new name written on the stone in which no one knows but he who receives it. So, Deuteronomy chapter 8, talking about man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. That's in chapter 8. I don't recall the exact passage in that one. Revelation in chapter 3, verses 11 and 12, has another one of these messages to the congregations. I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, so that no one will take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. And I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the new Yerushalayim, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name. So when you think about pillars in the house of God and a name written on them, what does that make you think of? Oh, 12 gates. You think about some particular pillars. Remember the two big pillars there with Solomon's temple had particular names. The names written on them, they be particular pillars. And so what do pillars do? They hold up the roof. They are up there to be a support. So thus, when you see it's a great image that you have. I'll make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. Because if you have a pillar in a house, do you want that pillar moving around? No, it doesn't work well if you just have the pillar just disappear. Because some people who are unwise will go into a place and just start knocking out walls, not realizing that some of them are load-bearing walls. And then what happens when you do enough of that? Yeah, the ceiling things, the roof may start caving in on you. Why? Because the pillars are there to hold up and to be a support. So thus, that's a good message to the people here and for this message to this congregation. To him overcomes, I will make him a pillar. So if you overcome, you have done what? You have faced a trial of some sort, faced some adversity, and you've held up and you've gone throughout the other side. You've gone through that baptism by fire. Yes, you've gone through it and out the other side. So thus, if you have gone into a trial and have gone out the other side, what are you then? Overcomer, but what are you to those who have seen this happen? You are dependable. A pillar, yes, you are dependable. You are something that will support other sorts of structures. So thus you see it, and we go to it a lot because it is just a very compact message there in the Apostle Yaakov in James chapter 1 when he talks about that, you know, when you face these trials of many kinds, what? Yeah, consider a pure joy when you face these trials of many kinds. Because this sort of testing, this overcoming, is to do what? To build you up so that you will be mature and complete, lacking nothing. And we've talked about before that mature and complete, especially the complete, is the analogous to the Hebrew word that you find of tamim, which is in our passage here today of Genesis chapter 17. When it talks about walk before me, and it says blameless, but walk before me and be tamim, be complete, not lacking anything. In other words, yes, you are someone who is dependable. You have faith, but you are also faithful. Yes, John, you have your hand up there, a comment or a question.
I was just wondering if there's been much conjecture on what Yeshua's new name might be.
Well, yes. Well, when you see some of those indications of the new name, you see like is written what? You get that on his thigh about what? King of Kings, Lord of Lords. There you go. And that name that you see of not just God saves, but God reigns. Because it's not just something out into the future, he will save. No, he is saving, and he has saved. So thus, it has now gone from a promise to promise kept. And the promise keeper then reigns with the name, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Yeah. So, as to specifically what the name is, but that's, we always know that names are a story that tells you something about where you're going, especially if the name changes to something. And you'll see in the word when it talks about descripting, he was called this because of, or he was named this because of. So as we see further into Genesis 17, that you have this sign of the covenant. And this really brings together both the passages that we read today in Isaiah 63 and also in Romans chapter 4. That this sign of this covenant of circumcision was not something that was new. Now, we know from historical records, we get some indications of it, that there were other civilizations that practiced circumcision of a sort, you know, but wasn't exactly the same. Some of what records we do have will be showing that with the Egyptians, their form of it was not something that was removed, but just basically an incision on it. And thus you see some of the pictures that could be perhaps related to later that you see in the Torah and talking about, especially in the book of Joshua, about that the second generation after the Exodus, they go through circumcision before they go into the land and before of Jericho to do what? To roll back the reproach of Mitzrayim. So, don't know for sure, but if there was indeed any of the first generation had continued the practices of circumcision from Egypt, that would be something that would get removed with the full sign of circumcision that would come later. And you're like, okay, well, great. Well, one culture makes an incision this way and another culture makes an incision that way. Well, who really cares about what you're doing one sign or the other? Oh, one be a eunuch. That goes into something. It's very interesting. John was asking, well, would that be a eunuch if you're making one cut versus another? Well, that is sort of what Paul is getting at in Galatians, especially Galatians chapter 5, when he talks about, well, if you are really interested in circumcision so much, well, why don't you just emasculate yourself? And the word they're used is basically take circumcision to the extreme degree. It'd be one, like a polite way to say what he was getting at with that particular turn of phrase. Yeah, basically the point is if you think removing flesh is going to accomplish something, well, why don't you just remove even more flesh while you're at it? If you think that is going to accomplish something. But, so that's then the question that comes in. Okay, you've got this sign of the covenant that comes forward. Well, what is this a particular message about? And like we had hinted a couple of weeks ago, and we saw in going through our Galatians study, and we saw in our passage we read in Romans here today, in Romans chapter 4, you know, when did this particular ritual, this sign of the covenant, come in Avraham's life? Yeah, when he was 99 years old. And after he had the previous encounters, and after, you see, as we read back in Genesis 15, verse 6, you know, that he believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. So that's part of trusting God, that he had already said, amen. He had already had this said, okay, be it as you will. You know, go forward in faithfulness for this. I will be faithful to this, what you're saying. And then heaven credited to that to him as righteousness. This circumcision was something coming much later in his life. So one of the things that you see is that this mark of this covenant is something that is talking about a promise that is going to be kept, and a reminder that it is not something that the flesh is going to take care of, because we've already addressed that with Ishmael already. This is something that the flesh is not going to accomplish on its own, which is very interesting in this particular passage that we see in Genesis 17, that who is among some of the first that will be getting this sign of the covenant? Interestingly, Ishmael is one of the first ones that is getting this sign of the covenant. Yeah, yeah, 99 years old, yeah, 13 years old, not fun whatsoever. Because you see later on in the accounts of Israel that that an entire city of Shechem was incapacitated for several days because of their circumcision at a much older point in time in history. But it is very interesting that thus you have this message from heaven saying, yeah, the son of the flesh, the son of your attempt to make this come about yourself, is himself getting circumcised. That he is also a part of this covenant, this promise that is kind of come forward, that Abraham was going to be a mighty nation. It was not going to be through Ishmael, even though Ishmael himself would be blessed and would be numerous. But that great blessing of really making a noise on the earth is going to come through Yitzhak and not through Ishmael. Even though you could argue, Ishmael has sure made a noise and descendants upon the earth has sure made a noise on the earth as well. But what will that noise ultimately be? Will it be like Havel, just something like the wind? It will come and it will go, and not be something that is a lasting impact, a lasting shaking up of the whole entire world. So as we see here further, that, you know, we men, it's always said that a lot of the instructions of the Bible are for men because we're the thick-skulled folk that really need it, that we are the ones that really need to get the message through. And we are the ones that have the toughest connection of really connecting to the things that are spiritual. Because why? You know, we men like to get things done. We like to solve problems. We like to have a problem and you find a resolution and then it reaches a conclusion and you move on to something else. That's one of the things that we men really thrive upon, is that sort of thing. But one of the things that you have for men is to remind, and this is a part of the sign of the covenant, is to remind about what legacy is that's being carried forward. And it's something that you'll see later on in some of the instructions related to where about, you know, for being circumcised to participate in the Passover, etc. It's basically, you know, when you see that you are uncircumcised, then you go to be circumcised. And that's a very interesting message, because what is then that a message to? That's a message to the one who should know, or the one who's old enough to know. So it's one of those things that it's not just something like you have the parents take care of it, and then it is of no longer any significance for the children as they grow up, for the sons as they grow up. No, it's something that you have to basically renew to cement that with inside yourself, that, hey, this particular sign means something. And we see that with the faith of the fathers, the faith of your ancestors. You take that in and you decide what it is you're going to do with that. Am I going to walk away from that faith, the trust of my ancestors ahead of me? Or am I going to embrace that and carry that forward to make it even more noisy on the earth, so to speak, to create an even bigger impact on the earth because of taking that message and that legacy forward? Because we just got done with the celebration of Hanukkah. And one of the things that you see in the books of the Maccabees, when it talks about the crisis of faith that was being experienced at that particular time period, that you see on one side, you had the very graphic description of a mother who was saying, no, I am not going to, I'm going to suffer, and my children, rather than to give up this legacy, give up the legacy that's coming down to us signified through the circumcision. But then you see on the flip side that it's recorded that there were some who did not want to go through the baptism by fire, so to speak. They did not want to face these trials that were coming against them. Seek the wisdom of, okay, what is it that this trial is telling me about? And then overcome it out the other side. No, rather it said, it uses the euphemism of trying to remove the marks of circumcision. And there's a few various accounts that we have of how they accomplished that in the ancient times. But basically, they were trying to not make it obvious to anyone that they were a part, what? A part of this covenant. That their allegiance was to someone else other than the kings of Greece or of the Seleucid Empire at that particular time period, or the gods that they served. No, your allegiance is somewhere else. And this is a legacy that is going to get carried from generation to generation to generation. So what? Yes, they actually checked them. Yes. They actually do have, in ancient times, they were actually checking to see what was happening, especially as the culture there in Jerusalem came to be more Hellenized with more of the Greek influence. There were more of the events and things, especially some of the gymnasium games and such that were being done. yes. Without any clothing on. So thus, whether you were having the sign of the covenant or not was under a Greek society came to be known pretty well. So I guess the question is that do we shrink back from this legacy that we've been put forward on, or do we move forward with it and overcome? And that is what gets us to the passage that we were looking at here today with Isaiah chapter 63. So when we were looking at that passage in Isaiah 63, it was really quite shocking in some of these situations. First, you have, as you scroll back to the beginning part of the chapter, you see that the Lord is coming in, and he's coming in, and it talks about it several times, that he is red with the blood of the enemies against the people. But it is interesting, as we see in this passage, how it goes back and forth between who is the real enemy of heaven or not. And you see at a time point that it could very easily be those who are called by the name that become the enemies of God, yet then become the redeemed of God at the same time. So in this particular passage we're looking at here in Isaiah chapter 63, you know, it starts out with this, the Lord is coming through to be having a vengeance upon those that are attacking the people. Because remember who it is that's the prophet Yeshayahu is talking to. He's writing to people that are what? In exile. The people in exile. So he's writing to them about the restoration and writing about the restoration of the land, the rebuilding of the temple, etc. So one of the interesting things you could see in this particular passage of Isaiah 63 is it's really a picture of a spirit-led journey that goes from bondage to freedom. And let's take a look in here further. Then, when the key passages starts out with in verses 9 and 10, in all their affliction, he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his mercy, he redeemed them, and he lifted them and carried them all the days of old. But they rebelled and grieved his Holy Spirit. Therefore, he turned himself to become their enemy. He fought against them. So, first off, let's take a look here at that particular word that's translated there as grieve. Here in this particular passage is atzav. And atzav talks about the root. Atzav relates to physical pain as well as to emotional sorrow from the theological word book of the Old Testament. So it's something that is reflective of not just pain physically, but also sorrow. And one of the other key uses of this term is in the account of the flood, when I talked about that the Lord was grieved that he made mankind. Atzav, the same word shows up again. So when you're seeing this kind of grieving, think about also back to the flood, and that the Lord was pained about having made the people, because thus you see the joy of having these people around and creating the people and having this communion with mankind, but then also what mankind decided to do with it. And a lot of it is very similar to the situation that ended up in the flood with the situation that's talked about here. And you'll see also the shades of the Red Sea crossing as well. So as we move forward, let's see some other passages that where the same sentiment is brought forward from Psalm 78, verse 40. How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. And you see as we get through into Deuteronomy with the retelling for the second generation after the Exodus, talking about, you know, how 10 times they rebelled. 10 times they rebelled against God. Yet, still brought through the second generation. That's even though the first generation, that they died off in the desert, yet the second generation was going to go in. And that being a great picture of our old self, which dies in the wilderness after we are freed from our house of bondage, whatever it is, our old way of life that we are freed from, that dies off in our journey toward the land of rest. Yes, Rosie, you have a comment or a question over there.
Find out how the 10 rebellions associated with the 10 plagues of Egypt. Were those the ten plagues of Egypt associated with the gods that they worshipped?
A lot of them are associated with the
10 rebellions against God, that first generation?
Well, let's see. It'd be an interesting thing to look at, but just offhand, I'm thinking about some of those rebellions, one of which is one we had read about earlier, about Massah and Meribah, and that was one related to about having water and then of having enough food to eat. Water turned to blood. Talking about the plagues, having enough water to drink. Yeah, it could possibly be. But yeah, about the having food to eat, that wasn't one of the plagues, unless maybe you might consider something like the frogs that were getting into everything. But that's kind of a little bit, or you might say that the hail, which rained upon the crops and destroyed the crops, and then the boils and such upon the cattle. It would be kind of an interesting thing to see if there was lice. Yes, lice biting the people and flies. Thankfully, not. I have not been bitten by one of those large horse flies. Oh, yeah.
He was bitten on the knee, and the blood just rolled out. It was a big blowfly.
Oh, my.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah, shoe fly shoe. Yes, indeed.
So I think there's an association there somehow.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, because one of the things that you see about where the plagues are really brought forward, you might say redeemed from, was with the giving over of the firstborn of the sons. And then that's fully carried forward with the firstborn of Israel with the tribe of Levi and the family of Aaron as priests, as being kind of like the firstborn of the firstborn, so to speak. But they are seen as that you must redeem the firstborn of males because of what was done, especially in the 10th plague to Egypt. So yeah, that was something, because you do bring up a good point, because a lot of the groanings and complainings that happened were about going back to Egypt. So it's like, well, you know, didn't you already see, Israel, that the Lord has already brought judgment 10 times upon Mitzrayim? Already brought judgment 10 times upon Mitzrayim. So now you want to go back to the place of judgment again? So, yeah, it is an interesting point about that, as to whether that was a lesson that, hey, you know, you may think because you are chosen that you are now free from any sort of judgment that may come down from heaven.
Right there in scripture that we just read, that he loved us, but yet he became our enemy because Israel kept going against God. Yeah. So now he became the enemy.
Yeah. And we'll see it as we go forward. Another passage from Psalm 106, verses 32 through 39. They provoked him to wrath at the waters of Meribah, so that it went hard with Moshe on their account, because they were rebellious against his spirit. He spoke rashly with his lips. They did not destroy the peoples as the Lord commanded them, but they mingled with the nations and learned their practices and served their idols and became a snare to them. They even sacrificed their sons and their daughters to the demons and shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and their daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. And the land was polluted with blood. Thus they became unclean in their practices and played the harlot in their deeds. So you see that there again as, you know, rebelling against the Spirit of God as being this function that's really working through in this movement from the house of bondage to the land of freedom. You know, these are not just, okay, verbal commands to start out with, then you put the commands on stone, and then you also write them on the book that goes next to the ark. So not just about the words that are on paper, because as the Apostle Paul astutely puts it, the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. This is something that comes straight out of the Tanakh or the Hebrew Scriptures, because if you are just following by the letter of what the Lord is saying, rather than the Spirit of the Lord, which brings the words to life, then you run a high likelihood of running off the rails, or, you know, looking for loopholes, which then lead to running off the rails. And you see the deacon Stephen has reflected upon this particular passage, be executed. It's recorded, an uncircumcised in heart and ears are always resisting the Holy Spirit. You are doing just as your fathers did. Which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? They killed those who had previously announced the coming of the righteous one, whose betrayers and murderers you have now become. You who received the law as ordained by angels and yet did not keep it. Because thus you see something that's going to be reflected on by the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 8, that the Spirit is what allows you to actually follow God's instructions, to keep his law. Because otherwise, you're, to paraphrase what Yeshua said in Matthew 5, verse 20, that your righteousness has not exceeded that of the scribes and the Pharisees, who knew the law extremely well and knew the traditions related to the law that were, you could say, originally intended to making sure that the people don't go off the rails again, like they did in the time of Yeshayahu that we're reading about here. But you see that also the deacon Stephan is reflecting upon this uncircumcised of heart. And we read this every single week from Deuteronomy 30, that circumcise your heart, circumcise your heart. And that was, Deuteronomy 30 was a message to the second generation coming out of bondage in Egypt, saying to them, yeah, okay, you need to be circumcised, follow this legacy that's coming down through Abraham. That is a part of this covenant, a sign of it. But it is not just enough to cut the flesh. Your heart has to be a part of this covenant. Otherwise, what? It just becomes what? Genealogy. It becomes, oh yeah, okay, I'm descended from that. But are you actually descended in, are you descended in spirit? Are you actually bringing forward the actual meaning and the heart of God through these words? Now, you may be a faithful servant in preserving the words. Great. Well, great. You accomplished that much in preserving the words and making sure that the words of God are faithfully transmitted from one generation to the next. But are you actually learning the heart of God through the words? Because you see that happened later on in Israel's history after this time that's talked about here in Yeshayahu. And you see that in the restoration that's recorded in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, especially in Nehemiah, where they actually are hearing the words of the law as they're read, they start weeping. Number one, because they hadn't heard them and those words hadn't been taught. And they hadn't been lived out either. So neither taught nor lived out. So thus, it's not just something to be teaching the words, but also teaching the heart of God that goes along with that. So in another passage we get from Psalm 51, which is, again, a psalm prayer that David is composed after the prophet Nathan confronted him over his affair with Bathsheba and his dooming of her husband to try to cover up the pregnancy. So level upon level upon level of going astray from the looking where he shouldn't have been, to then leading off and ending up with the death of her husband, to try to get rid of the evidence of the dalliance and the diversion and perversion that he had created in the situation. So with that, it said, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. So thus, it's a very interesting thing, because in the Psalms especially, you see these parallelisms that will show up in the verses, where one line will be saying a similar thing to what the next line says. So in this case, do not cast me away from your presence is paired together with, and do not take your spirit from me. So there you see a connection with your spirit and your presence as being a close connection there. So if you truly want God with us, that not just the words of God with us, but the heart of God with us as well, there must be not just the words of God, but the Spirit of God has to be, you know, causing these words to have life. So when we get back into Isaiah chapter 63, verses 11 through 14, we see, then his people remembered the days of old of Moses. Where is he who brought them up out of the sea with the shepherds of his flock? Where is he who put his Holy Spirit in the midst of them, who caused his glorious arm to go at the right hand of Moshe, who divided the waters before them to make for himself an everlasting name, who led them through the depths like the horse in the wilderness? They did not stumble, as the cattle which go down into the valley. The Spirit of the Lord gave them rest. So you led your people to make yourself a glorious name. Now, it's great we get this imagery from the Red Sea crossing that comes in there, because one of the things that you have, it talks about in Exodus explicitly, where it talks about this wind blew throughout all the night. And then you see prophetically, it's reflected on later in the Psalms, where it talks about he opened the seas with what? A blast of his nostrils. So thus you see that ruach, that wind that is coming, as being a key actor in this great salvation that's coming through from the sea, coming through from death into life. So thus calling the people back, remember, then his people remembered the days of old of Moses. And where is he who brought them up out of the sea with the shepherds of his flock? So this particular picture that we have of remember who it is that is actually leading them. Because remember, we had read in just a previous week before about the message that was given to the people on when they had their back up against the sea and they had the army of Egypt on the other side, but was being held back by the pillar of fire. And the Lord told them to what? Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. And thus, it talks about then they believed in the Lord and they believed in Moshe. So this trust in the Lord had to be something that was built over time and had to be built up. And you see with the first generation thought, as we saw in the passage we read earlier today from Exodus 19, you know, everything you said, we will do. Okay, great. But when it actually comes to overcoming, when you actually come, you are faced with the land and say, okay, go in, take the land. It's too much for us. The walls are too high. The people are too big. We're like grasshoppers in their eyes of the people of the land. No, what does actually the Lord see? The people are like grasshoppers. All the peoples of the earth are like grasshoppers. So those that will come and swarm, but in truth, really are not significant on the earth. Oh, significant to your crop, yes. But in and of themselves, they are just something that is small, that is short-lived, because the swarms come and the swarms go. But for the people of the Lord, when they're faced with this situation, and he puts their spirit in the midst of them, the wind of God was blowing with them. Could they then say later on, is the Lord with us or not? That trust that comes in the Lord, is the Lord with us or not? You know, and that's something that we see today. We can see with this symbol of Avraham coming through to us today as a sign of a covenant. Now, we as guys have to step up and realize the mission that we have of keeping this going from one generation to the next. We have to live it out, indeed. Live it out into the world to be overcomers. And that overcoming is not just by grit, because we men just love to just grit it and get through it, get it done. But in the end, are we going to stick with it? Are we going to truly overcome? Or are we just going to see this, okay, one mission accomplished, check that off the list, and then go back off to zoning out, doing this or that, or what other other distraction we can get involved with to take our eyes off of what the true mission and goal in life is. Yes, Deborah. Peter was saying? Oh, yes. Where can we go?
Where can we go, Lord, now that we know you're Messiah?
So you're the one who has the words of life.
I know Rose tells me that all the time. We both say that. You know, where can we go once you know this? You know?
Yeah.
It's the truth. You can't change.
Yeah, truly. That's one of the things that you see, and you see it in a number of particular passages, especially one that we've gone over recently with Hebrews chapter 10, where it's like, don't shrink back. Where have you seen this? Do not shrink back. Because that is a part of where it mentions earlier that, you know, some are giving up the assembling together. Don't shrink back. Keep moving forward, because our fathers and mothers in the faith before us have gone through a whole lot worse, a lot more than we have, and they have overcome. And thus we have the message from the Master telling us, hey, overcome to the end. Pull up your bootstraps and get walking. And part of it is take the Spirit of God with you. Make sure the Spirit of God is propelling you forward, because otherwise you're going to be walking and not realizing why you're walking and just give up or get distracted and go off to something else. But no, this is a mission that we have in life, is to keep plugging forward through it, no matter what it is that we might face in life, what other distractions we face, because the goal that we have forward, keep our eyes upon that land of rest, our eyes upon the one who gives us rest. We see that great miracle parable that was given to Peter out on the lake, where, you know, he went to go walk on the waters, and yet he got what? Distracted by the wind and the waves and the tumult around him. So thus, he started sinking down rather than keeping eyes fixed forward onto the one who helps us to stay above the waves of life that are raging around us all the time.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.